2. Hitching a ride. The anecdotal reports were wild. Crickets that normally inhabited the forest floor and didn't swim were leaping headfirst into ponds and streams. Frederick Thomas suspected that a worm seen wriggling out of the insect's body as it drowned was behind the cricket's suicidal impulse. But the only way to be sure was to go to New Zealand, where the phenomenon had been reported. In 1996, Thomas, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Montpellier in France, applied to the French government for money to investigate the matter, confident his proposal would be funded. Though he'd only just gotten his PhD, he already had 14 scientific publications to his name, a prodigious number for such a young scientist, so he assumed he'd be a shoo-in for a grant. What's more, an animal acting so flagrantly against its own best interests was clearly a topic worthy of study, or so he thought. Stunning him, the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, CNRS, France's equivalent of the United States National Science Foundation, turned down the proposal. He was so angered by their decision, he told me, that he decided to go on a hunger strike. For a moment, I thought he was pulling my leg, but his somber expression suggested he was serious. We were chatting on a veranda during a break in the Tuscan conference on parasitic manipulations where I'd met Moore. Thin with dark, tousled hair, Thomas came across as easygoing, confident in an understated way, and charmingly exuberant about his research. Now I wondered if his enthusiasm for his work bordered on crazy. CNRS is by far the largest funder of research in France, so it's not a good idea to piss off the folks there by threatening them. I scrutinized his face. Was there something I wasn't getting? Could I have misunderstood him? In fact, I had. He did not tell the CNRS that he'd go on a hunger strike if the grant wasn't forthcoming, he clarified. He told the president of France. I sent a letter directly to Jacques Chirac. You'd assume a low-level bureaucrat would open it, have a hearty laugh, and toss it in a wastebasket. But, amazingly, the import of his message, if not the letter itself, was passed up the chain of command to high-level officials. Far from generating laughter, his letter appears to have sent the French government into a panic. Officials from the administration were promptly dispatched to his university, where they pressed the chairman of his department to prevent him from carrying out his threat. If Thomas could not be kept from going on a hunger strike, they intimated to the department head, both scientists would pay dearly in lost grants. Evidently, the officials were unsettled by the thought of an emaciated Thomas turning public sentiment against the government. They put so much pressure on Thomas that he finally agreed to withdraw his threat. Deeply discouraged, the biologist was anxiously debating what to do next when a Swiss billionaire named Luke Hoffman heard of his plight through another scientist and came to his rescue. Known for his philanthropy and strong interest in biodiversity, Hoffman offered to pay half the cost of the expedition. With that backing, Thomas was able to secure matching funds from the Embassy of New Zealand and other sources, including the French government, which gave him a small sum, glad to be rid of him. Happy to have his troubles behind him, he went off to New Zealand, where he linked up with a team at the University of Otago, led by Robert Poulin, an evolutionary biologist whom he greatly admired and who was his source of information about the cricket. The two men immediately hit it off. A tall man with a soft, melodic voice and an amiable disposition, Poulin grew up in a French-speaking part of Canada, so he and Thomas shared a common language in addition to scientific interests. But their cricket investigation never got off the ground. They ran into the kinds of obstacles that Moore had warned often derail studies of parasitic manipulations. The insect came out of its burrows only at night and tended to hide among low bushes, and its green body perfectly matched its surroundings, making it hard to see even when in plain view. Even though the team scoured the landscape with flashlights night after night, often crawling on hands and knees through low brush, they caught only a handful of crickets infected with the worm, nowhere near the number required to run experiments that would produce meaningful results. After battling the French government and traveling thousands of miles, Thomas was forced to admit defeat. Not one to squander an opportunity, he switched to another scientific project. But before doing so, he sent a photo to a university colleague of a worm emerging from a cricket. Just to give news of me. Look what I'm up to. The friend posted the picture in his department's coffee station, where a lab technician happened to see it. A cousin of his in Montpellier cleaned pools for a living, he wrote Thomas, and they were full of the worms. Thomas was highly skeptical. The New Zealand parasite is just one of 300 hairworms, as scientists refer to this vast category of thread-like organisms. So he assumed the technician was mistaken. But when he got back to France, he met with the technician's cousin and gave him a jar of alcohol in which to put any worms that he found in pools. Thomas figured he'd never see the fellow again. But a week later, the man returned with a jar full of worms. He had collected them from a pool at a nearby resort, he told Thomas, who was very curious as to how they'd gotten there. I convinced my wife to go on a romantic holiday in the area because there was a hotel with a very nice restaurant with foie gras and a hot water spa nearby, Thomas told me. A mischievous smile spread across his face as he relayed this, hinting that he might have brought her there under false pretenses. After they had a lovely meal, he went on, he did not retire to the hotel room with her, but retrieved test tubes from the trunk of his car and returned to stake out the pool. Soon after, he saw a cricket approach the pool, and his first impulse was to step on it. Given his long journey to this moment, you'd think he'd resist the urge. But indeed, he did crush it, right there on the patio floor. Lifting his foot, he observed a 3-inch-long worm spilling out of the insect's crumpled body. The very same worm that had parasitized the crickets in New Zealand. He'd traveled halfway around the world to study a parasite and host that could easily be found virtually in his own backyard. A few minutes later, another cricket appeared and lunged into the pool. He leaned over to get a closer view. A living hair snaked out of its body. I thought I'd cry, he said. It was really incredible. 75 kilometers from my home in Montpellier is probably the best place in the world to study this cricket. At night, against the turquoise backdrop of the illuminated pool, the violent birth of the worm was as easy to see as actors lit up on a stage. In the subsequent field studies that he and his students conducted at an open-air pool near a forest in Avesnes-les-Bains, they had abundant opportunities to observe the electrifying spectacle. In addition to inhabiting crickets, the worms also turned up inside grasshoppers and katydids that similarly developed a mysterious attraction to water. Indeed, the enchanted insects came in droves. On a typical summer's night, over 100 flocked to the pool. In an effort to understand how the hairworm choreographed this remarkable show, Thomas's team began research on its life cycle. How could an aquatic worm get into a land-dwelling cricket in the first place? Once the hairworms break free of their hosts, the team discovered, they mate in the water, and the females then lay a string of eggs which develop into larvae. As they swim around, they bump into the larger larvae of mosquitoes and hop aboard them, hiding inside them as tiny cysts. Think of nested Russian dolls. When those mosquito larvae morph into winged adults, they take flight, carrying the parasite with them to land, where they die and are eaten by crickets. The dormant cyst then springs to life, eventually growing into a worm 3 or 4 times the length of the insect's body when uncoiled. They'd sketched out the broad outline of the hairworm's life cycle, but they rarely caught crickets in the act of jumping into a natural body of water. Something they very much wanted to see because ponds and streams, unlike swimming pools, are teeming with fish and frogs. Alerted by the splash, these predators would presumably snap up the flailing insect. The hairworm would have to be very quick in exiting its host's body to avoid being eaten itself. Could the creature be that fast? To gain more clarity on the issue, Thomas purchased a frog from a medical supplier and used an aquarium in his lab to simulate the natural conditions in which the parasitic manipulation occurred. Then he introduced an infected cricket and stood back to watch the show. In the blink of an eye, the frog ate the cricket, hairworm and all. Thomas was mystified. How did the worm escape predation in the wild when, in the simulation, it died with its host? It made no sense at all. A little while later, he got his answer. The worm squirmed out of the frog's mouth and swam away. After being swallowed, Thomas discovered, it actually got as far as the frog's stomach before turning around and traveling back up the animal's throat. Or sometimes it escaped through the frog's nostrils. When a fish snapped up the infected cricket, the worm exited through the creature's gills. It was an escape artist unrivaled in nature, the Houdini of the animal world. No one had ever seen this anti-predator defense before, said Thomas. Hulan had joined our conversation on the veranda, and he put the parasite's feet this way. It would be comparable to you having a tapeworm. A lion eats you, and then the worm crawls out through its mouth. The team's results were published in the British journal Nature, one of the most competitive and prestigious publications in science. I spent 25 euros, about $35 at the time, for the frog. That was the total cost of the experiment, boasted Thomas. The biggest mystery of all, how the parasite draws its host to a watery grave, had been the hardest one to crack. But in recent years, his team has uncovered numerous leads, each one more fascinating than the next. An infected cricket, they found, first begins behaving erratically, boosting the likelihood it will stumble into a pond or stream. But as the worm grows in size, eventually consuming almost all of the cricket's innards, something happens that leads the insect to more actively search for water. Was the parasite making its host thirstier? Thomas wanted to know. Or was it doing something else? To get at the underlying mechanism, his team extracted the worms from the cricket's bodies before and after they dove into the water. His graduate student, David Byron, a molecular biologist who is now at the National Center for Science Research and the Université Blaise Pascal in southern France, then applied proteomics, a new technique for identifying proteins made by an organism, for insights into the phenomenon. The results were eye-opening. The worm was producing a raft of neurochemicals that closely mimicked ones normally found in the cricket. If we don't speak the same language, explained Thomas, we can't communicate. So if I'm the worm, I want to talk to you in the same language. Natural selection favors worms that make molecules the cricket can recognize, facilitating crosstalk between them. In this way, the parasite can tell the cricket what it wants the insect to do. More recently, a team led by Byron made another intriguing discovery. Compared to healthy controls, the stricken insects have higher amounts of a protein involved in sight, possibly altering their visual perception. This revelation prompted the French researchers to explore whether crickets harboring the parasite are attracted to light. Indeed, they were, whereas the healthy insects preferred the dark. If you're a cricket that lives in the forest, said Thomas, what in your surroundings is brightest of all at night? An open area filled with water, an excellent reflector of moonlight. By tinkering with the settings of the cricket's visual system, he believes, the worm mesmerizes its host. It's effectively whispering to the insect, "Go toward the light." In an ironic postscript to his story, Thomas now heads a team at the National Center for Scientific Research in Montpellier, and is clearly no longer persona non grata in the eyes of the French government. In 2012, his work on parasitic manipulators and other biological topics earned him the CNRS Silver Medal, one of the nation's highest honors for people who have made an outstanding contribution to science. It's hard to imagine that a parasite could induce a human to plunge into water, but there is one that does exactly that. It's called the guinea worm, and, impressively, it achieves this feat without producing neurochemicals or going anywhere near the person's brain. In fact, it heads in the opposite direction. The worm, which is now mostly limited to Sudan, gets into people when they drink stagnant water contaminated with water fleas that carry its larvae. The acid in the human stomach kills the water flea, but not the parasites inside it, which develop into worms that slip through the walls of the intestines and mate inside the abdominal muscles. The males, which are only an inch long, then die and are absorbed by the body. But the female grows and grows, eventually stretching a yard in length. I once had the displeasure of seeing one coiled up in a jar of formaldehyde. It looked like a very long strand of spaghetti. As the worm develops, it snakes through the body's connective tissue toward a lower extremity, typically a foot or a calf. After about a year, the female is pregnant with a bustling brood of larvae. To usher them forth into the world, she migrates up to the surface of the person's skin. Until this point, the parasite has used various types of subterfuge to remain invisible to the immune system. But now she releases an acid that causes the victim's skin to bubble into a painful blister. The disease is called, not surprisingly, dracunculiasis, Latin for affliction with little dragons. If she's lucky, this burning sensation will compel the sufferer to dunk the inflamed limb in the nearest body of water. The moment the tapeworm senses the aqueous environment, she breaks through the person's skin and begins disgorging her young through her mouth. Hundreds of thousands of the larvae are ejected with each convulsion. Over the next few days, whenever she comes in contact with water, she again vomits up babies by the thousands. Once released, they swim around until they find a berth inside a new water flea and then repeat the ghastly cycle that will torment more humans, or sometimes the very same ones. People don't develop immunity to the tapeworm, so they can become reinfected. Just 20 years ago, the Guinea tapeworm infected 3.5 million people in 20 nations. But today, owing to education campaigns and simple, inexpensive water filtration systems, it hovers on the brink of extinction, with fewer than 100 cases of guinea worm infection occurring annually. Even in the parasite's last holdout, one of the poorest corners of Africa, it is now blessedly rare to see a person racing toward water on a worm's order. Some parasites don't alter only the behavior of their hosts, they transform their appearance as well. An outstanding example is the flatworm Leucochloridium, a favorite of parasitologists since the 1930s, for reasons that will soon become obvious. The parasite replicates inside a bird's digestive system and gets excreted in its waste, so a snail feasting on bird droppings may accidentally ingest the worm's eggs. Once inside the snail, the eggs hatch and eventually grow into long tubes that take over its brain and invade its eye stalks, the first step in the snail's dramatic makeover. As its eye stalks swell in size, their walls are stretched so thin that it's possible to see the parasite within, and what a dazzling sight it is. The worm is bedecked in colorful, pulsating bands, which are in fact pouches packed full of its rambunctious larvae. For my own part, I could have snails with leucochloridia before my eyes for hours, wrote one early observer mesmerized by the strobe light effect of the parasite's dancing stripes. As the snail morphs, it abandons its nocturnal lifestyle and becomes active during the day. Very, very active. Polish biologist Tomasz Wazalowski, an expert on the manipulation, clocked one infected animal moving 3 feet in 15 minutes, an Olympian speed for a snail. What's more, an infected snail will leave shaded spots on the ground that shield it from view and unwisely mount vegetation, often positioning itself on a high-up leaf with its psychedelic tentacles on full display. To a songbird overhead, those plump, pulsating stalks look like caterpillar grubs, enticing it to swoop down and peck on them. The victim of the ruse gets a beakful of tiny parasites that will soon reproduce inside its body. As for the snail, it may not only survive the ordeal, but also go on to regenerate its eye stalks. However, this may not be as merciful a turn of events as it seems, for the snail may be only a meal away from being reinfected and getting its eyes pecked out all over again. A tapeworm that infects brine shrimp is another talented makeover artist. It turns its normally translucent hosts bright pink, and that's not all. It castrates the animal, extends its lifespan, and possibly by fooling it into thinking it's time to mate, prods it to seek out other infected shrimp. Indeed, the infected crustaceans, each barely the length of a thumbnail, gather in such dense swarms that the water in those spots can form red clouds more than a meter across. This is very convenient for flamingos, which feed on the shrimp, and for the parasite, because the bird is its final host. And thanks to the tapeworm, the long-legged birds can satisfy their appetite simply by dipping their ladle-shaped beaks into the red seafood broth at their feet. Of course, what goes in one end comes out the other, with infected birds eventually releasing a new generation of the tapeworm's eggs into the water. Animals traveling in large packs, shoals or flocks, note Nicholas Rode and Ava Levens, the French scientists who identified the manipulation, are assumed to do so for their own benefit. For example, to find mates, deter predators from attacking, or enhance foraging strategies. Rode and Levens think it's time to re-examine that assumption. Perhaps far more often than we realize, parasites might be herding their current hosts straight into the jaws of their next hosts. While most parasitic manipulations come to light because a host is acting bizarrely, occasionally the discovery process follows a different script. A parasite is found tucked up inside an animal's tissues, and then, often acting on a hunch, an investigator looks more closely at the host's behavior and begins to suspect foul play. Such an intuition was the basis of a finding by Kevin Lafferty, now an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Lafferty, who looks as lean and fit as a Marine, and much younger than his 50-plus years, grew up in Southern California, where he spent his youth surfing, snorkeling, and scuba diving. To pay his way through college, he got a job that entailed removing mussels from offshore oil rigs. It was laborious work, but he was enthralled by sea life and loved being outdoors. So in search of a higher-paying gig to pursue his passion, he decided to get a degree in marine biology. Parasites were not initially a special interest of his. In fact, he gave them little thought at all until, early in his career, he taught a class on dissecting fish, sharks, and many other aquatic organisms. Every time he cut open a tissue or organ, parasites would fall out, he said. Many specimens had 2, 3, 4, or more. I started to think we were missing a big piece of the picture in trying to understand ecology and the interactions between organisms at different levels of the food chain. His interest in the environmental impact of parasites led him to study a ribbon-like fluke that sexually reproduces in the gut of egrets, seagulls, and other birds that frequent estuaries in Southern California. The birds shed the fluke's eggs in their droppings, which are eaten by horn snails along the shore. After further maturation inside the snails, the eggs hatch and are excreted. At high tide, the developing parasites get swept into the water, where they latch onto killifish, the most common prey of the shorebirds, invade their gills, and follow nerve tracks up into their heads. You can find thousands of the fluke's larvae caked onto the surface of a killifish's brain, said Lafferty. He'd been closely following the literature on parasitic manipulations, so the location of the larvae immediately raised his suspicions that the parasite might be meddling with fish minds. Puzzlingly, however, infected fish looked healthy and vigorous. Nothing about their behavior struck him as strange. Concerned that he might be overlooking a subtle change, he scooped killifish up in a net and released them into a large aquarium. His undergraduate assistant, Kimo Morris, was then charged with closely observing them to see if he could tell infected fish from their parasite-free peers. After many hours of scrutiny, Morris began to notice a trend. The infected fish were more likely to dart and shimmy along the surface, often rolling over onto their sides, a behavior that presumably would be conspicuous to predatory birds. How much more often did they do this? Morris tallied his observations of individual fish and arrived at a startling number. 4 times more often. The difference between the two groups was not so subtle after all. It seemed logical that shorebirds would be drawn to fish behaving so foolishly, but Lafferty and Morris wanted to be sure that their theory held up in the real world. To test it, they gathered a mixture of infected and uninfected fish into an open-air pen that they set up in shallow estuarine water, with one side of the enclosure abutting the shore. Birds could fly into the penned area or wade in unimpeded from the shore. They came in at first one by one, then in larger numbers. 3 weeks later, Lafferty and Morris dissected the remaining animals. Only a few of the healthy fish had been eaten, but almost all of the infected fish were gone. Observing natural selection play out in this miniature theater, said Lafferty, was highly instructive. Like most fish, killifish are dark on top and light on the belly. When they roll over on their sides, you see this bright flash, this silver glint. It's almost like someone shining a rescue mirror in your face. The fish that are infected are every bit as healthy as the uninfected fish. They just swim up to the surface and wave hello to the birds that come down and eat them. To figure out how the parasite could coax its host into acting so imprudently, he and graduate student Jenny Shaw analyzed the neurochemistry of infected fish. They found that the parasite was disrupting the regulation of serotonin, a neurotransmitter that influences the anxiety level of many animals, including humans. The popular antidepressant Prozac alters the metabolism of serotonin. Following that lead, the scientists conducted an experiment in which they traumatized healthy and infected fish by plucking them out of the water for several seconds at a time. Afterward, the healthy fish showed increased activity in serotonin circuits, a sign that they were under acute stress. In stark contrast, the infected fish had a muted response in those brain circuits. The more parasites the fish had, said Lafferty, the less stressed out the fish. This suggests it's so mellow that it doesn't get anxious in a situation that should make the animal fearful. It's less risk-averse, like a fish on Prozac. Most killifish that live near horned snails in Southern California's estuaries will be infected with the fluke by the time they reach adulthood. If we could actually see the parasite inside its host as we walked through these marshy areas, the fluke's numbers would astound us. For the snails, the killifish, and the birds it infects are almost the most common denizens of these habitats. And if we stood still for a while, we would see the parasites move from one host to the next, acting en masse like a giant conveyor belt carrying food from the ground to the sea to the air and back down again in an endless loop. What would happen if the parasites were removed from this picture? Would there be fewer birds in the sky? More fish in the sea? Lafferty doesn't know, but the change would almost certainly have a domino-like effect on the food chain. In some fragile ecosystems, where animals struggle to get by on scarce resources, manipulative parasites might even tip the balance toward the survival or extinction of a species. Lafferty recounted joining Japanese biologists who were studying a type of endangered trout in hopes of increasing its numbers. In the fall, the team noticed, the fish were unusually well-nourished. Their bellies were packed full of crickets. What had made this source of nutrients suddenly so plentiful? A hairworm, closely related to the species Thomas had long been studying, was sending droves of the crickets into the water in late summer. If it weren't for the parasite, said Lafferty, it's possible the trout might already be extinct. Parasitic manipulations may play a prominent role in determining human population size as well. Some of the world's worst scourges are transmitted by blood-feeding insects whose behavior may in turn be controlled by microscopic infectious agents. I must confess that I was surprised to learn such pathogens could be manipulative, not because I thought they'd lack the means, but rather because I assumed they'd have no motive. After all, these parasites need only wait for a hungry mosquito or fly to come by and bite their current host. Then they're up and away to new digs. What could be easier than that? Tragically for our species, however, the one-celled parasite that causes malaria, Plasmodium, is not so cavalier about its travel arrangements. This pathogen leaves very few aspects of its dispersal to chance. Accumulating evidence suggests it can regulate a mosquito's lust for blood to maximize its own dissemination. Still more impressive, it may alter human odor to enhance our attractiveness to mosquitoes when the parasite is most infectious. To understand how Plasmodium does this, it helps to be familiar with a mosquito's dining habits. To eat, the insect must pierce a human's thick skin with its proboscis and quickly wiggle it around until it hits a blood vessel. Time is of the essence. If the mosquito takes too long to steal a meal, its target may retaliate and flatten it with a smack. Almost as soon as the insect begins drinking, however, the victim's platelets rush to the site and begin to clump up and plug the leak. Sucking becomes increasingly difficult for the mosquito as this cellular debris clogs its feeding tube. To counter that, it injects an anticoagulant that breaks apart platelets, a move that will keep its dinner flowing smoothly a few moments longer. Then, skittish lest it gets swatted, it promptly sets off for a new patch of skin. Should Plasmodia be consumed along the way, however, this once voracious feeder soon loses its appetite. Scientists think they know the reason why. Plasmodia must reproduce in the gut of the mosquito before their offspring can be transmitted to a person. So if the insect continues feeding during this period, it risks being squashed with no benefit to the parasite. After 10 days, however, the parasite's progeny have reached a more infectious stage in their development. At this point, it's very much in the microbe's interest to crank up the mosquito's appetite, which it does by invading the insect's salivary gland and cutting off its supply of anticoagulant. The result is that the mosquito's proboscis quickly becomes gummed up by platelets whenever it attempts to drink. The frustrated insect can't get its normal fill of blood, forcing it to feed on many more hosts to satisfy its hunger. Incidentally, the bacterium behind the Black Death also obstructs the feeding ability of infected fleas, so when they jump from rats to humans, the insects bite us more vigorously. Plasmodium has still more tricks. Once it invades your circulatory system, it interferes with your ability to make platelets, so blood flows more freely when a mosquito comes to dine. In this way, the flying syringe can extract more infected blood to transmit to other people. As if all these manipulations weren't sufficient to guarantee the parasite's success, it may employ an even subtler form of sorcery. Plasmodia may bring mosquitoes and people together by exploiting the insect's ability to find us by smell. The hairs sprouting from their antennae have sensors that are very good at detecting the carbon dioxide we exhale, the lactic acid in our sweat, and the ammonia of stinky feet. When Plasmodia enter your body, they may amplify your natural odors or coax you to produce new scents enticing to mosquitoes. This claim is controversial. Not all research supports it, but a study of Kenyan schoolchildren certainly lends its credence. The investigators began by drawing the students' blood to see which of them harbored the parasite. They then divided the youngsters into a dozen groups, three children in each. Every triad consisted of a healthy child, a second youth at an early non-transmittable stage of the illness, and a third whose disease had progressed to the infectious stage. Mosquitoes were released into a central chamber connected by pipes to three small tents. Inside of each, a single child slept. All of the children were protected from being bitten. Twice as many mosquitoes were drawn to the youngster with transmittable malaria than to those in the other categories. Most intriguingly, when all the kids who had the parasite were given drugs that cleared their infection, the mosquitoes no longer showed a preference for one group over another. Plasmodia may not be alone in exploiting such tactics. The germ responsible for leishmaniasis, a largely tropical disease that can cause nasty skin sores and damage internal organs, may also make infected people smell more attractive to its insect vector. In this instance, sandflies. In studies of infected hamsters, the microbe changed the composition of the aromatic compounds that gave the animals, and by extension, perhaps also humans, their distinctive scent. Interestingly, the mosquito-borne virus that causes the excruciating joint pain of dengue fever, also aptly called breakbone fever, seems to take the opposite tack. Instead of coaxing humans to produce alluring scents, It boosts the insect's ability to track us down. It does this, as best as scientists can tell, by making mosquitoes more sensitive to human odors. That conclusion, though still tentative, stems from studies that show that the dengue virus alters genes known to affect the functioning of the smell sensors in a mosquito's antennae. These findings provide a very different perspective on vector-borne diseases. Not long ago, the insects involved in all these illnesses were assumed to be independent agents. They were calling the shots, not the germs that hitched a ride on them. But according to this new perspective, the passenger may in fact be the pilot. Thomas, Lafferty, and other experts on parasitic manipulations think people should be paying closer attention to this phenomenon. It's hard to argue with that view, given the devastating impact of these diseases. Malaria, despite mountains of money invested in vaccines and public health measures to counter it, still afflicts 214 million people in 97 countries. Dengue fever is soaring faster than any other infectious disease, with about 390 million new cases reported annually. And though once largely confined to tropical and subtropical regions, it now extends to southern parts of Europe and the United States. The parasites behind leishmaniasis and the bubonic plague together account for a few million more cases of disease each year. Clearly, there's a pressing need for fresh approaches to thwarting these epidemics. A promising avenue of attack might be to sabotage the manipulations that fan their spread. Perhaps, for example, a better understanding of the odors that stir insect pests into a feeding frenzy might suggest how to combat them with a subversive form of aromatherapy, a trap consisting of fragrances more attractive to mosquitoes than the human body's bouquet. Or knowledge of the genes a parasite activates to enhance a mosquito's sensitivity to human odor might suggest a way to block its functioning, cutting the insect off from the world of scents, the bug equivalent of a person being rendered blind or deaf. This much is plain. The better we grasp the nuts and bolts of parasites' manipulations, the more likely we'll be to succeed in throwing a wrench in the works, or, better yet, in finding a way to turn their power against them. Not just medicine, but also agriculture could benefit from such expertise. In recent years, millions of citrus trees have been destroyed by citrus greening, a devastating bacterial infection that turns ripening oranges and grapefruits green and bitter, and then kills the plants. This disease is rapidly spreading with the help of the Asian citrus psyllid, a bug whose behavior the microbe tweaks to enhance its own dispersal. The bug ingests the bacteria when it sucks up juices from citrus leaves, at which point the insect becomes a far more menacing pest. Compared to uninfected bugs, those that harbor citrus greening bacteria reproduce faster, hop more frequently from tree to tree, and travel longer distances. Arriving in southern Florida groves in 2005, the bacteria, ferried by the bug, quickly advanced through the state, jeopardizing its $10.7 billion a year citrus industry. In some parts of the peninsula, 100% of citrus plants are now infected. More recently, the destructive duo has moved across the southern United States to citrus-producing regions in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas and in Southern California. In response to this mounting threat, scientists are now intensively studying how the greening bacterium communicates its orders to the insect. The hope, of course, is to interrupt the chatter and rein in the infection, a development that could benefit citrus growers around the world whose crops are similarly imperiled by the microbe. So far, we've focused on parasites that view their host as a taxi to take them to their next destination. But many have very different motives for changing the behavior of the animals that harbor them. These parasites, which count among nature's worst thugs and torturers, deserve our attention. Not only is their means of livelihood fascinating, albeit in a diabolical fashion, but insights into their strategies could make us more alert to ways in which parasites might threaten our own autonomy.